400 deaths?
Approximately 400 deaths.
I think there's something a little bit wrong with your math.
All right, I'm sorry.
You said it was one death for every 5,500.
I'm sorry.
It's one death for every 55,000.
I'm sorry.
I suggest that our statistics are no better than...
All right, well...
No better than...
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry.
Zeros.
I missed a zero there. I was doing it.
Okay.
I'm glad.
Mr. Chairman?
I didn't try, Senator Shoemaker, I just...
Saying that our OSHA program is a good program and deserves support.
Oh, absolutely.
And you've got a whole flock full of friends in the legislature who would like to see OSHA continue to be successful and would lend their support. Now, having said that, looking through the list of fatalities, and if we leave...
Oh, just a second. Let me interrupt and ask whether our esteemed lobbyist representing the state's more prestigious business organizations wish to testify or wanted to have anything to say.
I'm going to be up to the Senate President's office. But are you going to have a future hearing on this?
Yeah, had you signed up?
No.
But you wish to testify to...
I can't, I'm so tired.
Well, it would be worthwhile. Or if silence is assent, then we can have the record so show that.
Silence means you'll fix it in the House.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Frederick, and have a good visit with the President. Sorry to interrupt. There.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm going through the list of fatalities, and it's hard to tell which of these could have been the result of rotten luck, or what was the result of reckless or negligent or willful or intentional violation of rule. But let me suggest that a lot of the electrical shock deaths would have been preventable, okay? And a lot of the caught and moving machinery deaths were probably preventable. The logging deaths are much more, you don't exactly know which way the tree is going to fall or which way the chain saw will be thrown back. So there's a lot less controllable activity in logging, but at least where a crane contacts an electrical line and kills the operator, that you're not supposed to operate a crane around electrical lines without a spotter, without full awareness of those electrical lines to prevent contact. Here's somebody who was apparently caught under wood dust and died of asphyxiation. Why was he in the bunker? I've worked in bunkers. I've worked in boiler rooms. They're extremely dangerous, and you do not go inside a bunker to poke the wood dust to get it to fall down into the conveyor unless you know it's going to be safe. It's extremely dangerous and kills people. And this guy apparently was caught. And that probably was preventable with appropriate tools. You get a 24-foot long pole, and you poke it from outside the bunker, things like that. Here's somebody who's caught in machine parts. Multiple parts were crushed. Here's somebody caught within a conveyor system. Multiple parts were crushed. Here's somebody caught in electrical wire, nervous system, electrical shock. Somebody who fell in a multiple head drilling machine and was crushed. Somebody have we taken a look at the fatalities in that regard, in regard to violation of rule?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, we do. In my involvement in occupational health and safety over the past 20 years, my involvement is that all occupational injury and illnesses are preventable and fatalities are preventable. Only about 2% are acts of God, that something happens on the line of electricity coming in or something happening that nobody had control over. I look at it a lot as a supervisory problem. If a person's in a bin, my guess is that's not the first time they've been in that bin. They've been allowed to do this over a period of time, and once you become accustomed to that type of work philosophy, you're going to do it. I always said that a worker's work involvement is directly proportional to how strong supervision is on the job, and you have to have supervision. And so these are all preventable, the electrocutions, the falling in bins, falling in rolls, and things like that. So we do look at these quarterly. In fact, I give a copy of the quarterly fatality to the Oregon AFL-CIO and Oregon AOI so they can look at them for their members to help them in looking at these problems, but they are preventable.
Well, then that leads me to my next question. That is, how many of these result from willful, reckless, or intentional violation of the rules? Although we can assume the preventable ones could have been prevented if the rules and good practice had been followed. But that doesn't tell us if the violation was willful, intentional, or reckless.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, number of willful violations during 1989-1981 to date resulting in an accident investigation related to a fatality was six. So we issued six willful violations from 89 to 91 on fatalities. Now, you as legislators have to determine whether that's criminal. Yeah, I can give you a copy of this, Senator Hill.
See, I'd like to have
what my problem is that there are willful violations of the law, i.e., that people have knowledge and they don't fix it. But in the cases I've been involved with where criminality has been involved, they have taken, like the Chicago case, they have taken people that couldn't read or write, made sure they couldn't read or write, put them in these areas where cyanide was, never told them. In the Cincinnati Milacron case, they sealed the whole room up. The employer went.
That sounds like intentional murder.
Well, that's, but again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, that's criminality, see, so you and your legislative wisdom is going to have to determine if our willful violations constitute a criminal fact.
That's what Chairman. All about.
And I will turn the information over to the respective people with our little segment of.
Mr. Chairman, Jack, you don't look at intentional or reckless. You just look at willful. That's your nomenclature?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, we have de minimis violations, which are not non-serious that we tell people to fix. We have serious violations, and they're all in our definition under OSHA statute.
Okay, your definition for willful or OSHAs is a violation that is committed knowingly by an employer or supervisory employee who, having a free will or choice, intentionally or knowingly disobeys or recklessly disregards the requirements of a statute, regulation, rule, standard, or order. So that you kind of roll in intentional or knowingly. Okay, but that would probably fall within the current language of the proposed legislation.
They parallel, in fact, council has drafted in order to do that.
Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Okay.
I'd like to know if not only have the knowing violations, or the willful violations, but also whether there was a pattern of violations previous in that workplace. Can you provide us that for those particular six cases in that time frame?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, we have dossiers on all our investigation over the years, and some of the information may be confidential on employee complaints, but we do have that. It's freedom of information.
I would like to know if those six cases, just for instructive purposes, just for us to understand what the incidence is.
Yeah.
If in those six cases there was a pattern, if
serious,
serious violations
serious
that led up, in other words, they had plenty of warning, they knew the problem, not just the one incidence, but others too.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, we'd be glad to get that information for you.
Senator Shoemaker reworked his number. For California, it's one death per 55,000, and I hate to tell you, Jack.
All right.
It's one per 43,750 in Oregon, so we'll have to. They're slightly ahead of us in deaths per, based on population, but with your continued leadership.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shoemaker, I feel kind of bad. I was trying to do that. I'm not a mathematician, but I think I want to use Senator Larry Hill's analogy that we have a lot of dangerous industry here, as in logging, you know, and maybe a cop a plea on that in there.
No, don't apologize. You didn't have your calculator. Would you do me a favor? And in fact, I'd ask you directly to, if you could, in writing, respond vis-a-vis the bill and it's the fact that it's now we've got apparently got this thing squared up and believe that it would fit within, as I think you said, fit within the process and that with your criminal investigators and this statute, you would then be able to pass the ball off to them based on the work of your criminal investigators and have, with the financing in place, not have to do this work to the expense of other work. So if you could, you know, I'm not telling you what to write, but if you could say that unlike 1989, we've now got this thing, I think, in shape.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's why we put the criminal section together.
Right.
With the possibility that this would, you know, be developed. I was trying to stay one step ahead of the chairman of the Senate Labor Committee.
Yeah, so well, Satchel Paige says you sometimes don't look back because it may be catching up.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
I'm looking at the administrative rules, and I'm looking at the other classifications of violations. Willful violations are one type, and that seems to be the most serious type, but a serious violation, which is less than willful, still requires the employer to a violation in which there's a substantial probability that death or serious physical harm could result, unless the employer did not or could not, with the exercise of reasonable diligence, know of the presence of the violation. So the serious violation assumes, by definition, that the employer knew of the danger. So I would say, and then there's a general violation, which is less.
General.
I would say a death that results from a serious violation also might fall within the range of the provisions of this bill. So I'd like to know that if there's six deaths that are linked to willful violations, how many deaths in the same period were linked to serious violations? No?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, at this time I don't know and would have to try to.
Would you be able to go to your data and relatively easily that information out?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say yes, but I'm not saying that with a lot of certainty. We will look at it.
I need to buy a computer system.
You've got the fatality list, so you might get.
Do you have a good computer system? Have the stuff in a good system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, yes, we do. Dan Adelman of our research is probably one of the best individuals in the country.
We've got the computer printout of the fatalities, and the question would then be to cross-reference that with the citation. All right.
That's good. For 85 and 87.
This is for 85 through 90.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pompei. In fact, if there are other amendments in addition to those, the one proposed by the Attorney General's office, we'll also ask you to give us your thinking about them. There is one which Ms. Talbot has identified based on the conversation with the California prosecutor, Ms. Chatton Brown, that they notify OSHA if they have information which did not come to them, in other words, if it came from another source, and I think we ought to close the loop by, if they have information that you do not, require them to notify you. I think that would be reasonable, don't you think?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 1037 and remind the committee we have Senate Bill 829. We're looking at the clock, and I'm going to call Ms. Wisher, Mr. Beal, Ms. Rosenbaum. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on 1037? Anybody else wanted to testify? Okay, we'll close the hearing on that.
Chairman, just for the record, Mr. Greg Peeble phoned my office and indicated his support for the bill and requested me to pass that on.
Okay, let the record show, Mr. Peeble, representing the Building Instruction
of
the Electrical Workers.
Electrical Workers.
IBEW. All right. If you wish to, who wants to go first and summarize your testimony?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Linda Wisher, and I represent the Oregon Council of Communication Workers of America. I am here to ask your support of Senate Bill 829. In both of our contracts with AT&T and US West, we do have contractual language covering safety committees. And I have attached an addendum to my testimony showing what our actual contractual language is. The fact is that in US West, our contract covers 14 states. So we have a safety committee that meets quarterly in Denver. which is not really an effective way to deal with local safety issues. In our AT&T contract, that committee also meets quarterly, but at AT&T corporate headquarters. So I don't want to beat up on U.S. West when Gary Wilhelms isn't present to defend himself, but I'm going to proceed anyway. U.S. West does have local safety committees, but those committees meet at the whim of management. Frequently, when U.S. West is going through what we call scorched earth policy or budget crunching, the safety committees do a disappearing act. Don't meet again for several different months. The Cascade Safety District, which is the one I'm most familiar with, which covers the area outside of metropolitan Portland, it last year met for the first 6 months of the year. Then we went through budget crunching, and the committee disappeared and reappeared miraculously at the beginning of this year with the start of a new budget. And U.S. West also, as a local president, my jurisdiction goes from Astoria to Baker. And we represent, in my local, a large portion of eastern and central Oregon. Frequently, those technicians in that area are left out of the whole safety process. They don't have the opportunity to participate on the safety committees because the safety committees seems to rotate down the I-5 corridor. And so those technicians completely get left out of the process, and frequently don't even get the information from the General Safety Committee that meets whenever the company so desires. Also, on Wednesday, you heard all the testimony from our CWA members in the Portland area about the number of workers' comp cases that have been filed regarding repetitive motion syndrome and carpal tunnel syndrome. Well, the company doesn't even, U.S. West does not even address that issue in safety committees. We don't have safety committees that address the needs of clerical people or operator people. And I think that that is a real fallacy on the company's part, that they really ought to have safety committees that help those people that work in those type of jobs so that they can better deal with the equipment that they face on a day-to-day basis. That's pretty much what I have to present today. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Okay. Questions? Not. Mr. Beal, are you next?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Beal, and I represent the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. We're here today to support the passage of Senate Bill 829, which you're well aware would remove the exemption for collective bargaining agreements from the safety rule requirement. To be very honest with you, we don't see the reason why that the exemption should exist, why collective bargaining agreements that have some sort of safety or regulation, provisions for safety committees, why they should be exempted from the mandated safety rules that are in the law. I would think even if one point I'd like to make, even if our negotiated safety committee's language in many of our contracts turns out to be better than what is required by the OSHA regs, we would have a harder time enforcing it than OSHA would. And if a bill like this doesn't pass, it would be my recommendation to our membership to take those languages out of their contracts and rely on the state. Okay. Right. That's basically my testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm last in the statute here. I was just reading it, but I am Diane Rosenbaum, representing the Oregon State Industrial Union Council. I, too, support the provisions of Senate Bill 829. I actually think its necessity is really more of an inadvertence than anything else, having listened to most of the testimony that took place during the very short special session. This may not have been the only oversight which was committed there, but I think it is an oversight. And I say that because the proponents of Senate Bill 1197, of whom I was not one, counted this as one of the big gains for workers, and there was never in any of the testimony that I heard that became the legislative history any discussion of the difference between collective bargaining situations and non-union workplaces. The discussion hinged more on the size of the workplace, whether 10 was really the appropriate number at which to start this requirement. So setting that aside, that I really think somebody failed to notice that there was another place in the statute that actually exempted people in unions with language from this whole provision. I think there are a couple of public policy reasons why it would be a good thing to correct. The first being that I personally think it's a bad idea to have provisions in the law that benefit the majority of working people and then go on to exclude people in unions who are covered by bargaining agreements which may address the same provision. I think it tends to create a situation where at the bargaining table there may be a tendency on the part of employers to try to hold that particular item hostage as a trade against something else that the union may feel is more essential. And there are other examples in the law that I think are probably more egregious than this one. And the one that comes to mind, as long as this is the week to beat up on U.S. West Communications, I'll get it out of my system, is the reinstatement provisions, which were strengthened greatly in the special session, actually do exclude our biggest bargaining unit, which is U.S. West Communications, which contract has a provision in it that if somebody is unable to return to their former job within 120 days from the date of injury, the employer can start a 45-day clock running, by the end of which time, if no job has been found, that employee is to be terminated. And because there's language in the reinstatement and reemployment rights of the law which says that they're subject to the provisions of a valid collective bargaining agreement, that language in our contract prevails over the much stronger reinstatement that is enjoyed by non-union workers in the state. That was a major tragedy for the people that I represent when that happened. So, the other reason I think sort of works the other way, why it's a good policy to have people in unions throwing their lot in with everybody else for legal protections, because I think it tends to make the law work better too, because what you have then is the people who tend to be the most vocal, aggressive advocates for workers looking at what's in the law and looking at the way it's implemented in the administrative rules and ensuring that it will work effectively. And that, in fact, is the reason why even before any of this legislation, a committee that I chaired, which put out a report on workers' comp and safety, had recommended repealing the collective bargaining exemption and simplifying the language in the statute so that unions would be working toward implementation of what had until that time not been a very effective use of the safety committee language that we had. So for all of those reasons, we urge your support of Senate Bill 829.
Okay. Questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Pompei.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Pompei, Administrator of Oregon OSHA, Department of Insurance and Finance. I would like to have a brief discussion and defer to you. I have a House Bill 3017 in where it's in my omnibus bill, and I caught this anomaly, and I wrote language that a collective bargaining is valid for a safety and health committee only if it's effective as or more stringent than our rules. And I'll defer to labor in your committee. I can drop this out of that House bill, but to have a collective bargaining section in a bill after we had Mahoney Hall was illegal. It does not supersede, you know, OSHA administrative rules. So I try to take it out with this House bill that will be heard, but I'll defer to you all.
I'd rather just send this little Hummer off to the House. They'll breathe a sigh of relief. Pick it up and move it along, if I had to guess.
Does our OSHA rules, Jack, require every employer to have a safety committee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, the new law says every employer with 11 or more employees must have a mandated health and safety committee and follow our rules, and we have very stringent rules written. Employers in the state which have 10 or fewer if you're a high-risk industry. In the top 25% SIC, you have to have them, where if you're in the top 10% of a low risk, you have to have them. But the mandatory committees are for 11 or more.
But there's the exception for the collective bargaining.
Mr. Chairman, that bill, Frank may address it, that bill was put in, that little caveat was put in our Health and Safety Committee rule many years ago. It just said if you have a bargaining, collective bargaining agreement for health and safety, you're omitted from the safety and health rules. And when I caught that, I told Representative Shiprack that this is illegal because a collective bargaining contract doesn't supersede occupational health and safety rules. And my language was that a collective bargaining agreement is valid only if it's effective as or more stringent. That would clarify the collective bargaining agreement. But as I said, I would defer to you to just take mine out of the House and let the Senate bill run. For instance, Senator Hill, if you look at the situation, a collusion between labor management could be that they wanted to negotiate to be exposed to lead at 100 parts per million, and you can't allow that. You have to allow what the permissible exposure level is. So I'll defer to this committee on this bill and take mine.
My interest would be, quite frankly, in repealing, in passing the bill and repealing that exemption and treating all workers, regardless of represented or not, treat them all equally and not even
mention.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I could defer to this committee, and I'll just withdraw mine in the...
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment, one piece of testimony that caught my attention was that even though you may have stricter provisions in a collective bargaining agreement, the mechanism for enforcing those may not be as effective as the mechanism for enforcing the state law is. So you have sort of divergent paths. I think to have it all together makes good sense.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Shoemaker, that's what OSHA is all about. Anybody that has more stringent rules, it's fine. We just make sure they have the minimum rules, and we can't enforce.
Rules are one thing, and what you do with them is something else again.
Enforcement is something else.
Yeah,
we want an outside agency or OSHA to be the ultimate authority on these questions, and not have some collusion or other kind of where the workers get ground down and things happen. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the enforcement of the safety committee rule went into effect March 1st. We gave, from the special session of May, June, we gave them a 6 to 8, 10 month, I better get my math right, I don't know how many months, from July to March 1st of this year to start to come into compliance with these rules. So we are enforcing the occupational health and safety committee rules at this time.
Okay. I want to move this little Hummer out so we'll have it.
I just wanted to ask, Mr.
Way.
Senator Hill. Jackson, the witness stand, have you hired those investigators yet? What's your hiring date?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, you mean the criminal investigators? Monday, bright and early, Monday morning, I interviewed five candidates that Mr. Sparks, I got two Sparks, not related. They will have somebody on board, hopefully a legal counsel by... in a couple of weeks, and then a paralegal.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We in work session?
We're about to be. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 829. Senator Hill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 829 to the floor to pass recommendation.
All right. The committee's heard the motion. Is there objection?
Sounds good to me.
Sounds like a winner to me also. We'll say that's good enough. And move Senate Bill 829 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
No deal.
I'm just wondering how much they'll fix in the House. They're going to be fixing lots of bills.
I think they'll probably be, is there anything else to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned. Senator Hill, I would suggest that there'll be a lot.
again and again, they will say, essentially, the management, we used to make our recommendations, and few of them would be implemented, and now there is a very much heightened awareness about the need to comply and a much greater commitment of resources to making the workplace safe. Secondly, in terms of going criminal versus civil, over and over again, we have defense attorneys coming in to plead the case that we file a case civilly rather than criminally. And they express a willingness to have their clients spend in civil penalties amounts far in excess of that that we could get legally in a criminal disposition of a case, simply to avoid the stigma of criminal prosecution. And, of course, we do not agree to that because our purpose is not to raise revenue but to deter unsafe working conditions. But it is, again, anecdotal evidence of the effectiveness of the program. Now, the only statistical evidence that I've seen was with relationship to construction fatalities, and certainly some other things could come into play here, but I think it is at least a substantial contributing factor, is the fact that in Los Angeles County, as opposed to other large urban areas, New York, Chicago, I don't recall all of the list of large urban areas. For every $1 billion of construction, we statistically experience approximately one worker death. In those other areas, they have approximately four worker deaths for every $1 billion worth of construction. So that puts us at about a four times better fatality rate than those other jurisdictions. And we believe that, although there may be some other reasons for that, a substantial part of the reason is because of the workplace prosecution program.
Okay. Senator Bob Shoemaker has a question, and then
Senator Hill asked a second question, which I failed to respond to, which was employer response.
Oh, yeah. Have they come around and now endorsed this program?
Well, they have not endorsed it, nor do we ever expect them to endorse it. Right now, their energies are focused on our new Corporate Criminal Liability Act, which just went into effect in January. But I can say that generally the employer community is much more accepting of, and when you talk to individual employers, they seem to understand. And I must say I have had this situation a couple of times. One employer in particular comes to mind where after the prosecution, and this was a large company with 17 different metal processing plants, they had had as their safety director, so-called safety director, their chief financial officer, who came in as a defense witness at time of trial. And on cross-examination, I inquired as to what experience he had with safety and health, at which time he admitted that he had no training in safety, and in fact his only involvement with any safety organization had been on one occasion attending a National Safety Council luncheon, at which he did not recall if there was even a speaker. I'm assuming that there was. But anyway, after that prosecution, one of the conditions of probation was that the company hire a full-time safety and health professional. As I said, this was a large plant with, 17 different locations. And the president of the corporation afterwards, according to his defense counsel who related the story to me, said that although he would never want to again go through a criminal prosecution, that in fact the program that was initiated and implemented as a result had reduced their worker compensation claims and improved morale. So I would say in general, the employer community has responded well. They will oppose it. They are opposing the federal legislation to increase the penalties under the federal act, but I think that, too, will eventually be enacted.
Okay. Senator Bob Shoemaker.
Yeah, thanks. We've talked a lot about what you do in the case of a fatal injury. I know that you also involve yourself in serious injury, which does not result in death. Could you give us a little bit of information about that? How serious must the injury be? How involved do you get? What does that lead to?
Right. Well, the injury does not have to be serious. It's really, we don't want to have it determined by what in fact occurs. We want to look at what might have occurred or what might occur. We have prosecuted for a number of very serious injuries, severe burns, etc. But we have also prosecuted, for example, for a release of chlorine that sent about 80 people to the hospital. Excuse me. Over half of those were children and teachers from a neighborhood school. No one received any in-hospital treatment. They were all examined and released. There may be some long-term damage, but certainly the type of hazard was a very serious one, and the violations were serious. That's what we consider in determining whether or not to file. Now, it's more difficult for us in our investigation of these because we don't have the trigger of the call.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. What does trigger it?
For these, we rely upon referrals from Cal OSHA and, frankly, reading the papers and hearing the news and inquiring from Cal OSHA where we read or hear about an incident that looks like it may have involved serious safety hazards. They do, however, routinely refer certain types of cases that we have requested to us, and we're hoping very shortly there will be a new chief of Cal OSHA. We're going to be asking them, as we have in the past, to refer to us automatically things such as all violations involving the Carcinogen Control Act. We certainly won't prosecute all of them, but we will.
What Control Act? I'm sorry.
Have a chance to review them.
But what did you say the name of that act was?
There's the Carcinogen California.
Oh, Carcinogen Control, okay.
Mm-hmm. Likewise, we are going to ask them to refer to us all repeat violations because we want to look at the people. You know, it's over and over again, people will say to us, well, why didn't Cal OSHA find the violation? The fact is that the matter is, with Cal OSHA, just as most state and the federal occupational safety and health program, the inspectors never go into most facilities. It's only in response to a complaint or a serious injury that gets Cal OSHA in the door where they can review the conditions.
About how many injuries do you investigate for every death that you investigate?
Not very many because of the referral process, and also it's an issue of resources. Because of the immediate notification, it's easier for us to develop a solid case in the situation of a death. We would prefer, as I said before, to have a more preventive approach, but we have to be sure that we have the necessary evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would honestly be guessing, but I would say we probably have approximately half the number of investigations involving injuries or serious exposures to hazardous substances than we do to the workplace deaths. There are over 100 occupational fatalities in LA County every year. Now, a substantial percentage of those, I would guess around 30%, are chronic exposures, asbestosis, silicosis, et cetera. And we do not, at this time, investigate those because of latency periods, the fact that the violations which may have been committed would be absolutely impossible, even putting aside a statute of limitations problem, to show 10 or 20 years later.
Of the 70, roughly, that you do investigate, about how many of those result in a conviction?
Well, we prosecute within our office about 8 a year.
About 8?
8.
8 a year?
Yes, but in it, but I need to explain something. The district attorney only handles felonies and misdemeanors in the unincorporated areas. So in addition to the 46 cases that we have filed, over another 36 have been filed by local city attorneys based upon prosecutions that we conducted. If we determine something in the city of Los Angeles, for example, is a misdemeanor and not a felony, we refer that to the Los Angeles City Attorney's Office and they file.
Without, I'm not so interested in the absolute numbers as the percentages, and it sort of sounds like about 10% of the fatal accidents end up in a conviction.
I think actually it's somewhat higher than that, because when you add in what the city attorney's office does, we're probably talking about more like 12 a year.
12 out of 70?
Yes, I would say that that is probably, so I would say less than 20%, but more than 10.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Senator Bob Kintyre. Well, I think my question sort of covered there with the last questions Senator Shoemaker had, but you earlier had mentioned 300 prosecutions, and I was wondering what percentage of those resulted in convictions.
That is statewide, and I don't have an absolute figure on that. Many of them were prosecutions that were undertaken prior to our having the program, or even during the early years of our program, by other jurisdictions where only the corporation was charged. In that case, the conviction rate, of course, is very, very high, because if it's only the corporation that's charge, most corporations will agree to come in and enter a plea. The real key is also to the effectiveness of our program is to also charge an individual. Now, in the cases that we've prosecuted, I believe that there are 4 of them that are still pending, 4 or 5. All the rest resulted in convictions of one or more of the defendants charged. But 2 of those cases involved multiple defendants, corporation and one or more individuals. And in 2 cases, a couple of different corporations.
Well, I appreciate, I'll ask if there are other questions from the committee or from Ms. Talbot. Apparently not. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and the committee for the time you've taken from your work and responding to our request for information. I appreciate it very much.
Certainly. I'm pleased to do it. We very strongly support adoption of the necessary laws statewide, and it certainly appears that you are moving in that direction.
If you would do me one other favor, I believe Ms. Talbot sent you some information, including a copy of the bill. If I can ask for one other, make one other request, could you not now, but could you take a minute or two to either transcribe or write down some your notes about Senate Bill 1037 from your perspective of what problems you might see in it administratively or suggestions you might make about it from your experience? Could you do that for the committee?
I would be delighted to. It appears a very good approach, but I will certainly give it a more critical review and see if we can make any suggestions to strengthen it.
And if you can if in fact you could see that it was on its face or with whatever minor modifications you might suggest, if you could in fact transmit that information to you, to me. I'm not looking for an endorsement, but rather if you could tell the committee in writing that the bill represents, in your perspective, from someone who prosecutes these cases, the kind of process that would replicate what you're doing, I'd appreciate hearing that.
I can tell you right now we do endorse it, but I will, the district attorney, I'm sure, would like to send a letter confirming that and giving more specifically the reasons.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time today. And with that, we'll say good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, appreciated that. That was always worthwhile. Now we'll call some of the folks we've got in the room. Yes. I think we'll take these folks first. We want to start with him. Okay. Let's start with Diane Rosenbaum.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I was sort of hoping you'd get some lawyers up here before me so I wouldn't stuck answering any technical questions, but I hope you'll spare me that. My name is Diane Rosenbaum. I represent the Oregon State Industrial Union Council, and I'm also representing the Oregon AFL-CIO today on this issue. The Oregon State Industrial Union Council and the Oregon AFL-CIO as well are in support of Senate Bill 1037. We believe that it is indeed a crime when a worker is needlessly injured or killed on the job, that it is figuratively a crime, and that it is time that it become literally a crime as well. By invoking criminal penalties for death or serious disabling injury involving a reckless violation of a safety rule or regulation, and by facilitating the investigation and prosecution of these cases, the bill would take a major step toward ensuring worker safety. We believe that criminal prosecution is a necessary part of an effective OSHA enforcement program. It is this enforcement power, both the criminal that is suggested here and the other penalties that OSHA already has the ability to levy, that really provide the teeth that underlie all of the other components of an effective safety and health program. Our experience has taught us that without a solid state enforcement effort, too many employers, and in some cases employees, will not take safety and health seriously and will not initiate the other elements necessary to an effective safety and health program. I think that the proposal that you're considering today probably has more symbolic importance for workers than any other sort, because probably the number of cases that will ultimately be prosecuted if this is enacted are small. But it will send a very real message to employers in this state that workers' lives are not seen as an expendable commodity. As Steve Hecker, who's a safety and health professional known to many of us in labor, once said to me, the attitude of employers sometimes seems to be that it takes 50 years to grow a tree, but it only takes 18 years to grow a logger, and that therefore the logger is somehow more replaceable than the natural resource, which is harder to replace. So we think that the proposal that you're considering adopting would really send a message to employers and to workers in this state that a worker's death or disabling injury is not something that is taken lightly in the state of Oregon. And we don't think that civil penalties, however aggressively they may be enforced or however the amounts are raised, will ever send that message as effectively, because as the witness in the teleconference said, that's perceived often as a cost of doing business and all too readily just written off on the ledger sheets, and not really, the message just doesn't get through that way. We also think that the recent addition to the OROSHA staff of two full-time criminal investigators, those positions, I understand, are in the process of being filled, will dovetail nicely with the proposal that you're considering, will make those investigators work more effective, and will facilitate the work resulting in some real benefit to workers. So we wholeheartedly endorse the bill before you. If it needs fine-tuning, we would be happy to consider amendments, but we do support the concept, and we hope you'll give it favorable consideration. Thank you.
Questions of the witness? Okay, thank you very much. We will call our attorney, Mr. Hittel, and Mr. Moore. Did he leave? He gave up on us?
He gave up.
Okay.
Chairman Cairns, members of the committee, my name is David Hittel. I'm here today representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a practicing attorney. I've practiced in the city of Salem for approximately 17 years. I primarily represent injured workers and workers' compensation cases. I am not a criminologist, nor am I a criminal attorney, so I'm not going to give you any information about what deterrent effect this might have from the point of view of a criminologist. I will just say that this has been reviewed by the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys, the Oregon Trial Lawyers, and is endorsed vigorously by both of those organizations. Number one, I'd like to say that we don't see it as a huge departure from existing law in the sense that both penalties and potential prison sentences or jail imprisonments have been existing. What we see it as, more than anything, is a mechanism to put into effect the law which now exists. Admittedly, there are some increased penalties under this proposal. However, I think the primary problem in the past has been the fact that they were not prosecuted vigorously by the various district attorneys, and I would think that that is primarily because they simply did not have the funds to do that. If you've been following the newspapers in our local community, you would see that in Marion County, for example, our prosecutor is asking for volunteers because they don't have enough money to prosecute cases. They're asking for volunteers of the bar to come in and prosecute cases for them. I think that the beauty of this particular proposal, strictly from the implementation standpoint, is that it will not cost the system any additional monies. The monies will come out of the 11 cents per day paid by employees. Should not have any physical impact in a negative way to the employers, employees, or the state of Oregon. I was very pleased to hear the testimony of the district attorney from California and can only again endorse what she said. In my practice over the years, I cannot say that I have seen numerous cases in which there has been what I consider to be reckless conduct on behalf of employers, but I have seen cases that I felt fit into that category and that probably there should have been some action taken. Unfortunately, there was not. I would like to see this bill given serious consideration and passed. And I think, as Diane said in her testimony, if nothing else, it will send out a message to the employers of the state of Oregon that they have to take safety seriously or there will be consequences. That's all the testimony that I have today.
Okay. Questions of the witness?
Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate you taking the time to appear. That reminds me that we have invited Mr. Penn. He was not able to be here today, but if his schedule permits, he did want to also testify. I believe had some favorable comments to make. We have Mr. Landau representing the Attorney General's office, and you have someone with you also, Mr. Wassman. All right. before you identify yourself, I want to remind the committee that when last we visited this subject in the 1989 session, we had comments and questions from the Attorney General's office. We've asked them to review this version and appreciate them coming at the invitation of the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Jack Landau, Deputy Attorney General. With me is Eric Wassman, Assistant Attorney General from our Criminal Justice Division. As you stated, we did get a chance to review this with a view to ensuring that some of the concerns that we expressed in the last session when a similar bill came up had been addressed. And we're happy to say that those concerns have been, in fact, addressed, and we are prepared to take whatever appropriate action is necessary to implement the bill should it become law. We're satisfied with the bill and think it's an appropriate use of the Attorney General's resources, if the resources are there. Mind you, in order to assist the district attorneys as is spelled out in the bill. We did have one minor suggestion, and we distributed to committee counsel that in the form of a proposed amendment.
Right.
On page 2 of the printed bill at lines 11 to 27, there's some proposed new language altering the current standards for violation of the law. As written, it provides penalties for anyone who recklessly violates the law and cross-references the criminal code. And what we suggested is simply to better track the language in the criminal code that's cross-referenced and change the language so that it reads intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, as those terms are defined in the same section that's referenced in the bill.
Just let me interrupt briefly. The members have this amendment in their file. I believe it's right underneath your bill, or it was before you shuffled through.
Or that they're still shuffling. It's one or two pages down.
The definition of those terms that they're proposing to insert are on your little chart of the comparison of criminal penalties from the existing statutory penalties to what the bill proposes. So if you're interested in knowing how
intentionally means with a conscious objective to cause a result or engage in the conduct. Knowingly means with an awareness that the conduct is of a nature so described. And recklessly causes serious physical injury to another under circumstances, manifesting extreme indifference to human life.
That's right. And, Mr. Chair,
does one have to ring the bell all three times or just once?
No, it's in the disjunctive, and one will do the trick. I should point out that the three terms are in the existing law, and we weren't sure if there was some purpose in leaving them out. But as you can see from the chart that the committee counsel points out, our amendment would better parallel the criminal provisions.
In fact, it would make it read right across.
Right.
Okay. And then, let's see. Delete line 27. Oh, we're just simply dropping that sub B and repeating the language there. All right. Would it be possible for you to send to me a letter expressing what you just verbally reported to the committee as to the nature of the bill, given the fiscal support?
Would be happy to do so.
I would appreciate it, and appreciate your comments when last we visited this subject and your time in reviewing this version. Richard, do you have a question, Ms. Talbert?
Yes, I did. I had a question in regards to sentencing guidelines, which a couple people on this familiar with, but I know that when I talked with Mr. Lemon from the AG's office, he had an estimate, perhaps, of what this designating them generally as Class C, B, or A felonies would result in terms of sentencing, assuming that they didn't have any prior criminal conviction. Could you describe what you think that would be approximately?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Ms. Talbot, we have here next to me one of the state's experts on the sentencing guidelines, so let me dish it off to him and give you a clear answer.
Mr. Wells.
Mr. Chair, counsel, no one is an expert on sentencing guidelines unless they have the grid in front of them. I unfortunately do not.
Okay.
My guess is that the Criminal Justice Council would have to or would probably assign an offense category for these offenses, probably in the range of from what on the grid appears to be 4 to 8, somewhere in that range. And we're probably talking here about defendants, employers who have absolutely no criminal history or no significant criminal history. So some of these offenses would fall into probation categories, depending upon where they were pegged. If they fell into an incarceration category, we would probably be talking about relatively short prison terms, about a year to a year and a half.
That's what, Mr.
Okay, if you could, in fact, it would be of real value if you would direct a communication to the committee with your assessment of that, with the caveats you've just made regarding the Criminal Justice Council and any possible determination they might make. Could you do that, Mr. Wilson?
Certainly.
I would appreciate it. Well, before we get
yes,
back to Ms. Talbot, Senator Kintai and then Senator Schumacher.
All right.
The bill seems to be speaking to any employer or supervisory employee. Now, I can easily think of situations where an employee other than a supervisory employee could be responsible for an accident, recklessly disobeying safety rules. Is such a person completely exonerated and then his supervisor held, or his employer, or is there any responsibility here for just reckless disregard for safety rules by just any employee?
We're going to ask that question, and Mr. Pompei has heard that question and on behalf of OSHA is here prepared to answer it.
Okay, I'll
wait. But he's heard the question.
All right.
Senator Shoemaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jack, just looking at the definitions of intentionally and knowingly and recklessly, it doesn't look from the definition that knowingly requires any mens rea, whereas the other two do. And are we getting ourselves into a situation where we have a Class C or B or ultimately an A felony possible without that, without mens rea?
For the edification of the non-Latin speaking members, would a learned counsel define the term of art?
Well, it sort of means evil intent or